Grant woke suddenly. For a moment, he felt dislocation, as if he weren't fully conscious. The impression was quickly crowded from his brain by the conviction that he was not alone. He also realized he didn't have the dimmest notion of where he was. As he opened his eyes to slits, he saw that he was in a bed, in a half-darkened room. His mind and body were free of pain. He sensed the presence of another person in the room, an unmistakably female presence. His ears heard motion behind him as he lay on his left side. He spun and sat up quickly, a sheet whipping away from his bare chest and slipping half to the floor. A woman stood there, stark naked, with dark hair cascading down over pale shoulders. She recoiled slightly at the suddenness of his actions, but stood her ground and smiled. She did not speak. She didn't have to. The smile said all. A small but insistent voice from the back of Grant's head said he should hold back, and he thought briefly of Shizuka. But before he could say or do anything, a terrible fatigue rose up to envelop him. He wondered just what was happening to him, or had happened. Then the bed reclaimed his body, and a dark cloud took him back down to the depths.
Excellent.
Zirok was looking through a one-way synthetic window so cunningly contrived that inside the cell, neither the subject nor the human female behavioral specialist could distinguish it from plain drab cell wall, painted texture and all.
The weak believe we must conquer humankind because of their weakness. The strong know we must conquer them because of their strength. Are you so sure of this method, Zirok? Our more direct avenues would have produced results by now. Sleep deprivation works wonders. Produced what results, Felix Commander Akhtar? The creature is neither scientist nor engineer, nor truly a technician. He's a warrior, as you are alleged to be. Would you learn of the tactics of his tribe, who don't exist in our world and whom you will never face on the field of battle? Or have you learned a degree of humility and suspect he might be able to teach you something?
The edges of Akhtar's ruff rippled, and he blushed in bands of subtle color, mauve, gray, faint powder blue, fainter old rose, across his head and neck.
You're a civilian! What do you understand of such matters?
Nothing, Phalanx Commander.
Zirok knew that Akhtar would interpret his tone as submissive, although the chief inspector's body attitude was neutral. Near horizontal, eyes looking directly at the military reptoid.
But I know two things. First, that this man has many uses to us, including, yes, the intelligence he can provide, all of which will be most readily available to us if he voluntarily makes them so.
It's ridiculous to coddle such beasts.
And second, that captive is claimed by the Chief Intelligence Directorate. Any dissatisfaction with that, or with the methods I choose to employ, you must respectfully take up at a pay grade far, far above my poor head indeed.
Zirok rolled his eyes meaningfully skyward, in a gesture universally understood among the members of the true race trapped in exile here on this vile dirt ball, even though the world's moon and its high base hung well around the curve of the world, far from the daytime sky at this longitude.
We have dosed him with subtle drugs, which weaken his discernment while leaving his intelligence and even his will itself fundamentally intact. And we provide pleasurable stimulus to counteract the unpleasant experiences your overzealous subordinates put him through to win his favor back.
Plain bribery.
Zirok performed a bow by tilting his body forward, the downward motion hiding his sardonic smile.
The Phalanx Commander is most perceptive.
I have better things to do.
Yeah. Zirok rose and put the dolt from his mind. He folded his arms behind the back of the somewhat shabby jacket he wore and turned again to study his latest acquisition with the intensity of the true enthusiast. Behind high walls of gleaming white stone, the royal hegemonic palace in Gloriana rose like a fairyland castle. Brigid and Domi rode toward it through the capital's broad streets in a great white and gold carriage drawn by 8 white horses with scarlet-dyed plumes nodding from their foreheads. A squadron of hussars rode before and behind them in gleaming breastplates and helmets with red, white, and gold hegemonic pennons fluttering from their lances. The city itself wasn't all of gold, as it first appeared to Bridget. The spires of certain tall or prominent buildings, like church steeples and a vast dome that Bridget gathered had some governmental function, were gilded. But many of the structures were built of white or tan brick and stone, much of it glittering with what she guessed was a high quartz or mica content. And the tiles, on many steep-angled roofs, were of a yellow-tan color Bridget was tempted to think of as topaz. The architecture was generally airy in effect, with even the most brutally plain walls, of warehouses and the like, supported by flying buttresses and pierced by many high windows with pointed Gothic arched tops. The streets around were thronged with people going about their business, mostly afoot, some in carriages or horse-drawn trolleys. A few cars were visible, clearly powered by steam. The only mounted persons Bridget saw were obvious policemen and cavalry, like their own escorts. The people in general looked prosperous in their quasi-Victorian clothing, the men all in hats and jackets, the women in long flowing skirts. They moved with a brisk ease, not, Bridget thought, as if they were subjects of a harsh police state. She saw no one shabby or visibly poor. Overhead, airships drifted through the sky, sausage shapes great and small. A few winged flyers were visible kiting against the clouds. Whether gliders or the electric-powered ultralight airplanes, Bridget couldn't tell. There also seemed to be relatively small dirigibles aloft with fat spindle gas bags. What depended from beneath them, none came close enough for Bridget to tell, even with her glasses on. But they were numerous, and seemed to be becoming more so as the clouds yielded to blue sky and sun. She guessed they were one- or two-person craft. The nearly translucent quartz walls surrounding the palace, which rose 15 yards from the street, were interrupted by a gate of what looked like gray armor plates twice as wide as high, held together with rivets as large as dinner plates. Against the designed delicacy of the city, what was visible of the palace towers and spires beyond it looked almost shockingly brutal. Bridget could only presume this effect was calculated, a recall to reality on the very brink of a fantasy realm, that within the dainty velvet evening glove was a fist of iron. The great grim plates slid sideways before the lead escorts to reveal black iron gates of looping, soaring, almost Art Nouveau tracery. These swung daintily inward to admit the glittering horsemen and the carriage behind into the palace grounds. Even Domi was impressed. She came out of her sullen reserve to press her nose against the window, her eyes wide in childish delight. Bridget could see why. The place looked to her like pictures of Disneyland. As with Cinderella's castle and the long-lost theme park, the architects had blatantly been influenced by the works of castle-mad King Ludwig II of 19th-century Bavaria. A man so consumed by his hobby, he had thrown over legendary beauty Lola Montez, inherited from his father along with the crown, to pursue it. The palace was no single structure, but a whole sprawling compound full of them, a city within a city. Although one great building, both wide and soaring, clearly dominated and was no doubt the hegemonic palace proper, there also stood a stone flotilla of ancillary buildings, barracks, storehouses, and others whose function was not at all apparent, and an entire cathedral of some size, interspersed among spacious gardens and pools and white gazebos with gilded roofs. Bridget was reminded of Versailles, or the gigantic monument to socialist bad taste and monarchic ambition built by Romanian tyrant Nicolae Ceausescu in the late 20th century.
I'm pretty sure Gloriana is built where Toronto was in our world. But this city had to have been built from the ground up. Toronto never looked like this.
Something knocked it all down.
Their fantastic procession trotted grandly up to the central palace, which combined high Gothic features with soaring mock medieval towers and turrets. They halted under a white porte cochere, all the cavalry mounts coming to a stop at the same instant as if their legs were wired to a single circuit. Bright and Cobden had seen the women into the carriage at a small tree-shaded station in a park a mile or so from the palace. The doors were now opened by a pair of white-liveried footmen whose powdered white wigs contrasted with their dark, strong-featured faces. Both were clearly Amerindians. Waiting behind them stood a thin young man in black coat, buff trousers, white blouse with cravat, and dark-tinted half-glasses. His skin was pale and so glossy it seemed stretched too tightly across his prominent forehead and supercilious features. His hair was dark brown and curly. He bowed perfunctorily. Behind him loomed four strapping, great-mustached guardsmen in white uniforms and gilt breastplates and helmets, so resplendent that Bridget felt fortunate they stood in the shade of the porte-cochere. In the sunlight, they would have been blinding.
Ladies, I am Sebastian Dalzell, Chamberlain. I am to be your guide. Please follow me.
Bridget and Domi found themselves walking with surprising briskness down a wide marble corridor whose ceiling vaulted high above their heads. The decor was muted. The light, which seemed to fall from cunningly placed and concealed skylights, as much as enter through high, narrow windows, was just past dim and lent the palace a cathedral aspect.
The proportions are designed to intimidate inside and out.
I'm hungry!
I apologize for any inconvenience, ladies. At the moment, I fear we dare not tarry. We are running late, through no fault of your own, of course. After your audience, all your needs will be amply attended to. My word upon it.
Dalzell pivoted smartly left down a lower-ceilinged, narrower, dimmer passageway lined with white marble busts set in niches on pedestals. Soft radiance fell from above like halos at intervals of 4 or 5 yards. Bridget glanced at Domi. Despite the Outlander girl's shorter legs, she seemed to be having an easier time keeping up with the brisk pace set by Dalzell than Bridget, who was taller and longer-legged than either. He stopped at a door on the right. It was a solid-looking oak door with some subtle figuring on it, otherwise unremarkable. Two of the four palace guardsmen, they couldn't possibly be anything else in those comic opera outfits, took up positions of rigid attention flanking the door. The other two assumed a sort of parade rest posture behind the two women. Bridget noted a detail she had overlooked before. Each wore a basket-hilted sword in a gold-fitted silver scabbard, straight-bladed, and hung from a white baldric at the left hip, nearly vertical so as not to trip them when they walked. If they carried firearms at all, they were well concealed.
Ladies, it is my inestimable honor to present you to Her Benevolent Hegemonic Majesty, Queen Fiona, Protector of Humankind and Empress of North and South America.
To Bridget's surprise, they were ushered not into a throne room, but what appeared to be a steam-age briefing chamber. It was long and narrow, with the usual decor, stained wood paneling, silver-figured wallpaper above, lush carpet of a deep grayish purple, brass gas lamps with mauve shades, dark yet somehow without seeming gloomy. Instead, it implied comfort with great power. Two features dominated: a long table, like a narrow ellipse, truncated at both ends, and the queen herself lounging in a chair at the far end of it. She was much younger than Bridget expected. She could be no older than her early 20s. She had dark wine-red hair, a red markedly different from Bridget's own, with a metallic, almost coppery sheen to it, wound in a braid tightly around her well-shaped head. Her features were classic and haughty, a trifle square, with a slender nose and eyes of a blue so deep as to approach violet. These gazed at the newcomers half-lidded as Her Majesty puffed on a long black cheroot. Bridget could hardly smell the smoke. Mostly what she smelled was the scent of sprays of fresh lilac, presumably hothouse grown, in vases set on walnut pedestal tables at intervals along the walls to both sides of the table. Queen Fiona wore tan jodhpurs, black calf-length riding boots, one crossed over her knee, and a loose blouse of what seemed bleached muslin, with the sleeves unbuttoned and rolled up carelessly to her forearms. Her skin was very white, with the bluish undertint of a truly pale redhead. She appeared to be tall, at least as tall as Bridget, somewhat broad in the shoulders, of a general wiry athletic build.
Your Majesty, may I present to you Dr. Bridget Baptiste and Miss Domi, travelers from far places.
The Queen uncrossed her legs, swung around in her chair, and leaned her elbows on the table.
Perhaps, perhaps not. They may come from a place very near, but which we cannot see. Right? Here. Fascinating.
Ladies, you may now perform curtsies.
Bridget did, to the best of her ability, which was scanty. As she dipped down in what she hoped approximated proper respectful form, the corner of her vision snagged on Domi, who stood rod upright, glaring laser defiance at the queen. Brigid tugged at her sleeve. The albino woman, though much smaller, had muscles like wound wire, and she resisted successfully. The net effect of Brigid's efforts was to pull herself almost off balance and transfer the focus of Domi's glare from Fiona to her. Fiona sat back in her chair and looked lazily at them again.
Young woman, whether you bow or not, I'll still be queen.
Perhaps. Perhaps not.
Spirit! It's actually easier to admire on one who isn't a subject. In guests, or even captives, defiance can possess a certain charm, whereas in subjects it's merely inconvenient.
Brigid tried to puzzle out whether there was something sinister to the young woman's words or not. She was already certain that, titles apart, it would be a dangerous mistake to underestimate the barely post-adolescent Fiona.
Where are you from?
You summed it up as well as anyone could, I believe. Your Majesty.
You seem tentative, Dr. Baptiste, as if nonplussed to encounter me in such surroundings.
Fiona waved a languid hand at the flocked wallpaper and the portraits of glum men in uniform in ornate gilded frames.
As if you expected to find me in a throne room rather than a conference chamber. Well, I've a throne room. It would hardly be suitable for the ruler of the world's greatest empire not to. But it's big, drafty, and somewhat silly, and the acoustics are terrible. I prefer at least somewhat more intimate settings when there's something I actually want to learn. And yes, I am aware that juxtaposing silver and gold is in shocking bad taste. My great-grandfather's taste, actually. I'm quite powerless to make any substantial changes. Bad taste passed on for more than two generations becomes tradition, don't you know?
I'll admit I wasn't expecting to encounter a queen in such a setting, but I'm more concerned about our status, whether we are guests or prisoners.
That's a metaphysical question, isn't it? For now, it pleases me to treat you as honored guests, despite your small companions continuing to glare at me as if hoping I'll melt. Then again, you might well consider yourselves prisoners. You are not permitted to leave the palace grounds, or indeed the palace itself, without escort, for reasons of your own safety as well as that of the hegemony. I note your skepticism, Dr. Baptiste. You will have to accept my assurance that you are in peril. The world you have come to is in a state of flux, and much of the turbulence centers upon this, my capital. And you two are valuable prizes. Others will not be slow in attempting to snatch you away from the hegemony. But rather more to the point, you are prisoners in this world in which you find yourselves, are you not? Because unless I miss my guess, the marvelous device on which you are relying to take you home is quite inert here.
As she spoke, the queen's right hand dipped out of sight behind the table and came up holding the experimental interphaser Brigid had carried in her pack. Fiona turned the object over in her hands.
It does have a certain eldritch aesthetic to it. If it weren't so unwieldy, I might use it for a scepter. Who knows? I may anyway. An artifact of otherworldly science might be a most fitting emblem for the ruler of this entire world.
You dream big, you. A world is a big place.
It is, and I do. But once the apocalyptic engine is complete, that by itself should lay the entire world at my dainty feet, for none will then be able to resist my science.
She grinned ironically as she displayed her boots, showing feet that were anything but dainty. Experience had taught both Domi and Brigid that such things as the declaration of ambition to bring the world to its knees was akin to one's kidnapper pulling off his mask and allowing his face to be seen, a moment of revelation that had certain implications.
Don't be so alarmed. Yes, the apocalyptic engine is a state secret. And no, your lives aren't forfeit for hearing it, because all the world knows of the apocalyptic engine and its equally enigmatic creator, though no one speaks of it openly. As I'm sure you've been apprised, this world is full of spies, like maggots in cheese.
Though her mouth smiled, her eyes dissected the two women in turn. Abruptly, the queen stood, Her carriage showed the grace of a gymnast, as well as the arrogance of a mighty monarch.
I must say, it has been a pleasure meeting you, both of you. My own private world is so circumscribed that it becomes stultifying. Sebastian will see you to your quarters, which I assure you, you shall find more than comfortable. If I keep you in a cage, it is not merely gilded, but plush and well ventilated. You will, of course, be subjected to endless questions in upcoming days, which may become tedious. But I can promise you also that the last thing my people will want to know from you are details of your personal lives, so you need have no fears for privacy.
But, Your Majesty, surely you have questions.
Doctor, I lack scientific and technical expertise. I employ experts for that. The very best in the world, as it happens. The ones who shall ask you questions are those who know the proper questions to ask. It isn't worth my while to know. I have little time for idle curiosity. It killed the cat, you know.
The office smelled of soap and violets, whiskey and cigars. A huge hand, crisscrossed by scars and liver-spotted with age, laid Kane's utterly inert and useless sin-eater on the green baize blotter on his immense desk with gentle finality. The President of the Republic of Cibola then shifted his gaze to Kane.
Son, what the confounded tin-plated, made-in-Malagasy hell are we gonna do with you?
He winked at Rodriguez Satterfield.
Young Randy here says you're a good man in a fight. And of course, you're a visitor from another world, and the yellow journals will doubtless make a fuss about you. But in terms of news I can use, against the Silver Kingdom, the Domain of Kali, the Ruskies, the Texians, and longer term, the Lizard Boys and those damn Canadians, anything you might be able to tell us would be as fascinating and useless as this here piece of ironmongery.
Let me guide an expedition into Canada to rescue my friends, Your Excellency.
For a moment, President Preston Archer stared at him. He was an enormous old man with a great seamed square face that sagged only slightly around the edges. He had an eagle's beak of a nose with winter blue eyes as keen and fierce as any bird of prey looking out from beneath extravagant bushy brows. Like the hair that hung down in a magnificent fall past the color of his lightweight ivory suit and the sweeping mustache that almost hid his mouth, his brows positively gleamed a silvery white. The ruffle-fronted white shirt he wore behind his jacket barely contained a massive belly, but he had chest and shoulders to match. The way he spoke and looked at Kane and held himself, even as he sat at nominal ease in an oak chair in his spacious but relatively Spartan office, said that even if the decades had taken a toll on him, he was a force to be reckoned with. About as harmless as a Rocky's Avalanche or Great Plains Twister, Kane judged. Kane reflexively sized him up and reckoned he could take him, but his speed would likely be his sole advantage.
Excellency. Excellency, what kind of hogwash these boys been feeding you, son? Ain't nothing excellent about a politician. And mind you, I say that as a man who's been one, man and boy, for nigh on 60 years. And as for your modest proposal, Dean Swift has nothing on you. For that matter, maybe nobody has, for monumental brass, since old Eric the Red named a godforsaken glaciated rock Greenland and sold plots of it to other Vikings. Marie Carolina, more elderberry wine, if you please, and seat our guest. Voicing such vaulting ambitions has to have dried out the boy's throat.
A voluptuous Latina with gray streaking the black hair piled atop her head and slanting jade-green eyes came into the room with a tray and a grand sweeping of the dark gray-green floor-length skirt she wore. Her blouse was mauve.
Maria Elena? What the devil are you doing here?
Maria Carolina is busy discussing the budget with the Senate. It's a slow day at Foreign Affairs, so I'd promised I'd spell her waiting hand and foot on you.
The woman paused next to Kane's chair to pour dark purple fluid from a square cut crystal decanter into his wine glass. Her eyes met his, lingered, and then she swept on to refill the president's cup, a silver mug built on a scale as heroic as he was.
Never should have made that woman Secretary of Finance. Excuse a woman's sense of the priorities.
You always fill cabinet positions with your ex-wives, dear.
Well, third time's a charm. Never had a peep from my critics about nepotism. I calculate being so blatant about it just takes all the challenge out of it.
Kane took a sip of his wine. Aside from knowing he didn't want to arm wrestle the oldie, he didn't have any idea what to make out of the new president of Cibola. After the collapse of the unlikely alliance with the hegemony, his predecessor, a literal use of the word in this case, had promptly been assassinated. In the ensuing snap election, Archer had won in a landslide to a third term in the big house.
Now, Mr. Kane, you've got balls. Damn. Glasses, Maria Elena is still in the room somewhere.
She left, Mr. President. The bespectacled man who spoke was Charles Glass, Archer's aide. He sat beside the president's desk in an attitude suggesting an eager hunting dog. The resemblance was reinforced by the numerous hunting scene prints that hung in frames about the dark-paneled walls, although these were outnumbered by battle scenes, both painting and sepia-tone photographs. These could have come from 3 centuries past in Kane's world. Except the one nearest Kane had a little brass plaque beneath, bearing the engraved copperplate inscription, "The Retreat from Santa Fe, September 1st, 2112.
Oh, thank God. Anyway, you got balls, and we Cibolans admire balls. But to be real candid with you, sir, balls are really nothing more than Rocky Mountain oysters yet to be harvested, if you take my meaning. If most of our enemies hadn't had more balls and brains, we'd have been plowed under 10 times over.
Major Kane is a most intelligent man, Preston.
Kane stared questioningly at Rodriguez Satterfield, reacting to the title of Major. The colonel winked.
He's also extremely resourceful. Nor do I believe him to be a man who says things without reason or speaks because he's much in love with the sound of his own voice. Though I have to admit, I'm a little taken back by the breathtaking speed with which he cut to the bone here.
All right. Then, damn it, Mr. Major, suppose you tell me why, in the name of a million tons of buffalo crap, we should send an expedition skyhooting across 3/4 of a continent to attack the highly fortified capital of the strongest nation in the Western Hemisphere, if not the whole blamed world.
First, a question, if I may, Mr. President.
Preston, if you please, that's who I am. President's just what they let an old fool play at being every few years for entertainment's sake.
Preston, what makes you so sure Baptiste and Domi, my friends, have been taken to Gloriana?
Glass squirmed like a schoolboy in his eagerness to answer that one, but Archer needed no prompting.
Oh, the Limey. Miles Burnham's there. There's no place else they'd take him. Because if there's a man on Earth who can find a way to make use of the advanced technological knowledge from your world on this strangely circumscribed globe of ours, he's it.
Then all the more reason to rescue them. Bridget Baptiste was a senior archivist for the barony we both served before becoming fugitives a few years ago. That meant she had the job of reviewing records, historical, political, cultural, and also technical, that survived from before our big nuke.
So you caught a catastrophe that blighted your world too, did you?
Yes, sir. About a century and a half later than you did, and man-made, not natural.
I'm not sure you could call the Great Destructor natural, whatever the hell it was, but go on.
Now, Baptiste is not a white coat, not a scientist or engineer herself, but she had the job of reviewing countless technical documents, including scientific papers and engineering blueprints, some of which undoubtedly contained knowledge that is going to be transferable to this world. News you can use. Are you familiar, sir, with the term eidetic memory?
President Archer leaned forward and placed his elbows on the desk before him.
Son, you just go right ahead and elaborate.
The shell's explosion produced an orange flash, instantly obscured by the vast eruption of earth, sod, and dense smoke. Through it rolled a land ironclad, 17 yards long, with 2 gun turrets fore and aft. From the top of the superstructure amidships, a Gatling gun smoked from behind a splinter shield. Grant and Zirok stood atop an observation tower that overlooked the vast practice grounds. The Reptoid shook his head.
Ridiculous, isn't it? A star-faring race, reduced to employing weapons and vehicles from centuries in its own past. glorious and somewhat checkered though it was.
Grant wore a uniform of midnight blue with high stock collar and gold buttons. It was meant for an officer of the Reptoid's human auxiliary forces, although lacking rank or unit insignia. It seemed remarkably plain for this world, or at least the somewhat abbreviated and kaleidoscopic impressions of it that Grant had received the past few days. Underneath the uniform, he wore his shadow suit. That still surprised him. That the Reptoids permitted him to keep such an artifact, which even his host captor Ishmael admitted was representative of a technology far beyond their own capabilities, struck him as remarkable. Especially since the shadow armor, whose function was almost entirely passive, and due to its compositional weave of spider silk, monochris, and spectra fabrics, still worked, even when his subcutaneous biolink transponder and even his sidearm didn't. Otherwise, he wouldn't be here. Another big vehicle appeared through the smoke, and the earth exploded around it.
Buried charges. Command detonated to mimic heavy shellfire. Realistic training's good, but with live artillery, accidents can happen. War machines cost us heavily and scarce resources, and our race is the scarcest resource of all. Besides, with enemies on all sides, even though the damned Alliance has broken up its own internal contradictions, authentic dangers, none too hard to come by. Just leave St. Louis and drive.
Grant felt himself oddly flushed, as if he were submerged in slowly heating water. He was brooding again, he knew it. It was hard to control. The anger had always been there, he knew, but it was never far beneath the surface these days.
Why did he say that?
The lizard man looked at him with a wrinkling of his brow. The Reptoids had fewer mimetic muscles than humans, but they were capable of a range of facial expressions, if comparatively subtle ones.
Why did that bastard Mackenzie ask if I was their master or their slave?
Zirok scratched his flat chin with a pair of taloned fingers to gain time. Several times the subject had recounted the story of his and his friend's arrival and reception at the hands of the hegemonists. Initially, he was kept unconscious and questioned under the influence of Reptoid drugs. Then, several times, he was consciously debriefed by the chief egg inspector, who portrayed himself as his case officer. But strangely, this was the first time the subject had asked this question. It was a sign that his will was beginning to return, and that the most ticklish phase of Xerox's plan had begun. Unlike many of his compatriots in the intelligence game, Zirok felt no attraction to lying for its own sake. A lie intrinsically complicated situations. It was hard to remember, and he knew from frequent observation, as well as bitter early experience, that the fact he personally was very good at lying was more a trap than a facilitation. He had therefore set himself to master the more abstruse art of carefully filtering the truth.
You've heard a little about the great change that came over this world centuries before we arrived. The global devastation, enormous initial loss of life, which in turn was dwarfed by subsequent deaths to starvation, disease, and, of course, anarchy.
We had something a lot like that, only it happened a century or so later, and it wasn't a comet.
Which I admit I find intriguing, my human friend. Although what hit this Earth doesn't seem to have been a comet, in any event, you may or may not realize that it struck during a North American conflict often called the War Between the States, or the Civil War, which was fought in part over the issue of slavery.
I knew that.
A land ironclad stopped almost in front of their wooden tower. A heavy steel ramp winched down from the bow, with much puffing of smoke from tandem stacks mounted behind the pilot house. A squad of Reptoid infantry spilled out in their camouflage battle dress and coal scuttle ceramic synthetic laminate helmets, bayonets gleaming on their bolt-action rifles. As the vast armored vehicles sprayed out covering fire and the inevitable smoke pall began to settle over the scene, teams assembled portable Gatlings on heavy tripods and began to crank rounds down the practice range.
When the aftershocks had finished circling the globe, the slaveholders of the southern states discovered, like everybody else, that their firearms wouldn't work. The percussion caps they used to set off the powder charges contained tiny dabs of high explosive, and high explosives don't work here anymore. So the guns the slave owners relied upon, in large part to subjugate their human property, didn't fire. Only some old flintlocks, since black powder still works fine, as you can see for yourself right here. The slaves held a disproportionate number of those among the light weapons that they were allowed to keep for hunting. They rose up. The slaves were numerous, and most white men fit for military service were away fighting the Union. News of the uprising spread, carried by messengers and the movement of rebel bands. Communications were disrupted. Long-range telegraphy was another casualty of the Great Destructor. Confederate soldiers could not be recalled to fight the slaves. Neither could Union troops be dispatched to put down the uprising, as they surely should have been, since the slaves' actions were as much against the law as those of any violent mob.
So the slaves won?
Yes. I hope you won't take offense, but they didn't prove themselves more enlightened in ruling their former masters than the masters had been.
Doesn't surprise me. It's not my world anyway.
True enough. They exterminated the whites by and large throughout a large part of the southeastern sector of what had been the United States. The surviving whites were themselves enslaved. As word filtered out what had happened, African descendants began to immigrate to the newly liberated or conquered lands. Not always voluntarily. Whites in the north were panicked by what had befallen their southern cousins. There were massacres of blacks. Thousands more were simply driven from their homes and herded south like droves of cattle. And in time, as the rebel states began to coalesce into what would become today's Empire of New Africa, they themselves began military operations to forcibly repatriate blacks from neighboring regions, whether they wanted to go or not.
So that blonde son of a swampy whore's question
was a deliberate provocation. In all the Americas, slavery only exists legally in the Empire of New Africa, the Empire of Brazil, and the Dominion of Kali, where it's recently been introduced. And people of your skin color and general appearance are very rare outside of New Africa.
Hell of a thing to say. Hell of a thing.
Zirok took a risk and clapped his human companion on a powerful bicep, being careful to withhold his slightly retractable talons. The big human didn't flinch away or lash out in reflex anger.
Come, my friend, let's go inside. There's not much more than a fog bank to be seen here now, and I, for one, am working on a powerful appetite.
Kane, dressed in fine clothes that felt alien to his body, was trotting down the broad steps of the Capitol with Colonel Randall Rodriguez Satterfield and a group of his allies, when a man broke from the crowd of spectators on the street below, strode up to Kane, and slapped him across the face with a glove held in his right hand. The blow caught Kane flat-footed. He belatedly swung up his own hands to defensive posture and jumped back. He repressed his reflex action, which was to jump on the slagjacker and pound him through the concrete steps to show him what it meant to lay hands on a magistrate. He didn't know the lay of the land here, as this peculiar attack demonstrated vividly. Rodriguez Satterfield and his supporters didn't reach to restrain Kane, but moved swiftly, if subtly, to interpose themselves partially between Kane and his attacker, like the small, quick, clever dogs he'd seen them use to herd their great horned cattle. The man made no further move on Kane, which was the best decision he could have made. He was tall, almost an inch taller than Kane, with brown hair receding at the sides, cut medium short and slicked back, and razored sideburns spiking down scarred, tanned cheeks. His eyes were gray, and his nose had been broken more than once or twice. He was slender as a rawhide lariat, and dressed in an immaculate dove-gray tailcoat over white blouse and ivory trousers with slightly flared cuffs. The outfit differed little from what Kane had been stuffed into by Rodriguez Satterfield family servants at the order of Randall's magisterial Aunt Cecilia, except Kane wore a dark blue jacket and blue-gray trousers with muted maroon stripes down the legs.
You shall hear from my second, sir. I suggest you appoint yours.
I'm his second.
The colonel stepped up beside Kane, as did two of his friends, Barker and Burciaga, who had accompanied the men out of the capital.
Go ahead and state your case, Silvero. Your seconds can call on me later to work out the gory details.
Neither of Rodriguez Satterfield's associates looked particularly concerned by the incident, nor had either shown any sign of making a move toward the sizable handgun each wore beneath his long jacket. An unarmed man was the exception here in Cibola, not least of all in the Senate he'd just finished addressing.
My principals object to this, ma'am. His ludicrous and patently spurious claims offend them. They desire to foil his mad attempts to embroil the Republic in desperately dangerous adventures far from her native interests. They therefore engaged me to chastise him.
And then he turned and walked away. What the fuck?
You have just been challenged to a duel, amigo.
By a professional duelist. João Silveiro. His friends would call him Johnny, if he had friends.
Kane looked around. It was tubby, balding Ned Barker with his extravagant sideburns. Burnsides, they called them here, who had spoken. The singular-looking man beside him nodded. Francisco Burciaga was so tiny he was almost a midget. And he was so handsome with his dark olive skin and raven's wing hair and obsidian eyes as to be almost pretty.
He's also a Brazilian assassin.
In the couple of days Kane had spent here, largely at the vast Rodriguez Satterfield estate northeast of Auraria, he'd gotten to know the type of men Colonel Randy ran with. Richer than God and well-seasoned man-killers, if not full-on cold hearts. For his part, no matter how much he missed its reassuring weight on his forearm, Kane was just as glad he wasn't carrying his now inert sin-eater. He gathered drawing down would have been a severe gaffe and possible sign of cowardice. He just hoped that if things dropped in the pot, he'd remember to draw the burly double-action Taliaferro 50-caliber automatic revolver riding at his own hip, rather than just making a fist and expecting it magically to fill up with a blazing full-auto hand blaster.
Assassin? They're open about that sort of thing here?
It's a crime to commit an assassination here, not to be an assassin.
A duel. You have got to be shitting me.
Not at all. One of the stupidest traditions I've ever come across.
Like the president, Barker had one of those big bellies that, if you took the possessor up on an invitation to punch him there, would hurt your hand. He had been a real swashbuckler in his time, a far-ranging trader who made and lost a dozen fortunes in some of this world's hairiest locations, before settling down as an industrialist, manufacturing small arms and steam engine parts in a huge factory complex 40 miles south of Auraria. Burciaga flashed teeth in a quick, white, angry smile.
Hardly, Barker. It helps us keep a polite society and calls the herd, so to speak. And that's as far as this line of palaver ought to go, unless we want another duel on our hands.
Kane felt frank relief. He was no coward, but he was also not fool enough to want to get caught in a crossfire of friends falling out. Civil wars were always the worst. Burciaga had a cattle ranch the size of a European count's fief out on the plains east of the capital, before reptoid-backed barbarians overran the continent. He was among the most highly regarded horse breeders of the upper Rio Grande, a position of high esteem in a world whose technology relied largely on literal horsepower. He was also a successful militia cavalry officer who specialized in guerrilla tactics. He was also largely Apache, Chiricahua Apache, and what's more, Mexican Chiricahua. They ranged the southern reaches of Cobaltville, the barony Kane had served as a mag, and their reputation as fierce, implacable warriors was legendary.
I've been here 2 days. How could I get somebody pissed enough at me to call me out?
What the man said, I suppose. The passionate appeal you just made to our august legislators to launch a fresh expedition eastward to spring your lady friends from Canadian Durance Fire.
Word travels fast, what with telephone and telegraph. And speaking of which, gird your loins. We're about to run the gauntlet of the gentlemen and ladies of the press, which I fear will make your hair-raising escape from the hedges seem like a walk in the park, Mr. Kane.
This part of the Golden City, Gloriana, didn't look so golden. Bridget stared out the window as the carriage rolled through streets narrower and dingier than those that had first led her to Fiona's extravagant palace. The carriage was less grand and ornate, and the escort of horsemen in spiked helmets and glittering cuirasses, while smaller, seemed to have a less ceremonial intent. Domi sat as far from Bridget as the carriage would permit. She had observed that Bridget seemed to be taken by the Victorian trappings of polite society and was allowing herself to become more gullible as a result. Domi didn't put it in quite those words, however.
You're falling for their crap.
You're just being reactionary. The Canadians aren't perfect, but no one is. For their part, the Canadians seem to care deeply about social justice and order. And if they followed expansionist policies, it would have the effect of displacing social systems far worse.
That's what the Baron said.
Those were almost the last syllables the women exchanged. Fortunately, Fiona had delivered on her promise of luxurious confinement. Their quarters were a suite with two spacious bedrooms and even two bathrooms, so they had been able to share their imprisonment apart. They were allowed to eat in their chambers, for the most part, and when they were escorted from the suite by polite, soft-spoken men to be interviewed by other polite, soft-spoken men, it was most often singly. Bridget had never thought of herself as a sociable person. An archivist's life was intrinsically solitary, and besides, denizens of an enclave were not encouraged to form personal connections. Yet she felt her isolation keenly. There was no one here she felt a connection to, at least no one she knew, other than Domi. If only it were Cain, she thought, and promptly stepped on the thought. It didn't lead anywhere she cared to go. Besides, in essentially Victorian Gloriana, she and a male co-captive would no doubt be kept scrupulously segregated except under closely chaperoned circumstances. Still, Bridget acutely experienced something she had seldom experienced before. She realized, with something of a shock, as she sat gazing out at shabby, careworn people, walking bent over and hurriedly past, with occasional hooded looks cast at the carriage and its glittering lethal escort, that for perhaps the first time in her life, she was permitting herself to feel lonely. She felt a pang at the unfairness of it all. For all of its flaws, life as an exile at Cerberus had brought her out of herself, forced her from her shell of apparent self-sufficiency. And now she was marooned, friendless, in a realm more distant from her own than the Andromeda Galaxy. The carriage halted before a looming Gothic pile that, to judge by the lakefront behind, was a warehouse, or had begun existence as such. It was coated in streaked soot and grime. The rest of the block was similarly monolithic, smudged, and run down. The cavalry lieutenant who led the escort opened the carriage's gatefold doors and personally handed the women out. A pair of troopers stood flanking a multiple-layered arched doorway with bolt-action carbines shouldered. Another pair stood to either side, facing warily outward, down the sidewalk with long blasters at port arms. Bridget felt surprise. What on earth could the Queen intend in sending them to what very clearly was a rough part of town? Still, part of her was amused. In her life as an exile, she had had ample experience of the Tartarus pits beneath various baronial monoliths. If these pony soldiers thought these streets were mean, she didn't know whether to pity or envy them.
I'll leave a guard here at the door, ladies. They'll ring round for the carriage when your interview is concluded.
Thank you, Lieutenant.
Domi said nothing. She had gotten over the point of violent resistance, indeed of open display of any sort, except the occasional sullen glance at her tormentors. Inside, they found a great, echoing cathedral space filled with café au lait light, drifting dust motes and mechanism. They stepped inside, necks craned upward, looking in wonder and puzzlement. Great gears turned lazily in complicated trains, some seeming barely supported. Ratchets caught and released, cams turned, great pistons thrust and returned, driving flat ring-like brass dials as wide as houses. A complex dance of steel and turned brass.
Ladies, welcome!
Striding across the floor toward them came a figure not much larger than Domi, dressed in tan breeches, a white blouse with sleeves rolled up, and a green waistcoat. His youthful-seeming face was clean-shaved beneath a great mass of unruly auburn hair. He had half-glasses pulled down to the tip of his long nose and a black smudge on his cheek. He wiped his hands on a rag.
Please forgive my manners for not meeting you at the door. I am Dr. Nigel Miles Burnham.
Good morning, Doctor. My name is Bridget Baptiste. This is Domi.
The albino woman had produced a yellow apple from within the red and yellow dress their servants had stuffed her into that morning and bit into it, gazing around with ruby eyes, huge.
Welcome to my workshop. Rather a shocking breach that you must introduce yourselves. I suppose the army dropped you off at the door and bade you shift for yourselves. They're rather fearful of what I'm about here. I do believe they're more than halfway suspect me of witchcraft. I apologize, Dr. Baptiste, Miss Domi, and I assure you I'm entirely charmed to meet you both. Please forgive me again. Of course I've been told to expect you. After all, it was I who predicted your arrival.
Miles Burnham seemed to teeter on the brink of uncertainty how to proceed. Bridget offered her hand. Miles Burnham hesitated a moment longer, then grasped her hand fervently in both of his and shook it. His hands, slender but disproportionately long for his height, were surprisingly strong. The hands of a craftsman, it seemed, not a cloistered scientist. Bridget smiled to put him at ease. If there was any faint hope of returning home, he was it.
That's right. Your instruments detected our coming.
The scientist smiled. He seemed rather relieved that Domi hadn't offered her hand.
Well, not quite, Doctor. You'll think me mad, and I beg of you not to tell our mutual hosts, but the plain fact is, I foresaw your arrival in a vision.
Ha! The curved blade descended toward Kane's forehead. He strove to bring his own saber up to parry the cut, but the cavalry-style weapon, heavy to begin with, felt as if it weighed 25 pounds. It was hopeless. The sword flashed down between Kane's eyes. It stopped with the curved blade's tip an inch from the skin of his forehead. It hung there a moment, motionless.
Very well, Mr. Kane. You are a man of exceptional physique, conditioning, and skill. Your reflexes are superb. Your eye is as keen as that of a falcon. You learn as if absorbing through the skin. I salute you.
The man's mouth was set like a razor slash in his pale face, where it seemed hardly more than just another scar. He was a head shorter than Kane, his close-cropped hair salt and pepper. His eyes were dark and intense under eyebrows like lines drawn in charcoal. He had been introduced as Walloon, whatever that was, and had been one of Europe's leading swordmasters before the continent fell into barbarism, an event that had taken place less than 5 years before.
But you got me dead to rights.
Of course, you are a beginner. In 10 years, I can make you a swordsman.
I've got 2 days.
Then you can learn to make a brave show and not disgrace yourself in dying.